It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Tomorrow night, NPR and ABC News political commentator Cokie Roberts is being honored as Chatham University's Elsie Hillman Chair in Women and Politics. And she'll present the lecture, An Insider's View on Washington, D.C. In her more than 40 years in broadcasting, she has won countless awards, including three Emmys. She has been inducted into the Broadcasting and Cable Hall of Fame and was cited by the American Women in Radio and Television as one of the 50 greatest women in the history of broadcasting. And in 2008, the Library of Congress named her a living legend, one of the very few Americans to have attained that honor. She joins us now by phone. Cokie Roberts, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. I want to point out that the operative word there is living, living legend.
Got it. You are certainly an insider, and you have seen a great deal, which covers a lot. So what will you be focusing on tomorrow night?
Well, it's the Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics at Chatham, and I am very interested in that subject. They're doing wonderful work of research about women in politics in Pennsylvania, where the pickings are slim, if the truth be told. And so I'll be talking about the importance of women in politics in addition to just the general political situation here today.
You've been a political commentator for
forever.
For decades. But, who's counting? Is it difficult for you as an analyst to keep your own political beliefs out of your analysis?
No, because really, when you do it as long as I have, you stop really having political beliefs. You care about the issues and you care that people understand the issues, but you see both sides all the time. And you see people who make a lot of sense on one side and people who don't make any sense on the same side and vice versa. And so it's really a question of just trying to explain it.
So should an analyst still be objective as far as you're concerned?
Well, it depends. It depends on what role you're playing in terms of your place in the journalistic pantheon. If you're in a position where you are giving opinions, either in an op-ed page or an editorial page, or in a broadcast environment where people know what to expect is opinion, that's one thing. If you're supposedly just telling it like it is and trying to do it as straight as you can, that's another thing. It really depends. It's a question of truth and labeling. Let the viewer, listener, reader know what you're doing and then follow that.
But I'm wondering if you've ever gotten to the point of being frustrated with one point or another or one aspect of politics that you're covering and said to yourself, I'm tired of pretending like I don't know better and putting something that might be opinionated out there.
No, not really. There are times when you have to use your judgment about whether to make something equal when it's not equal. If there's a piece of legislation, for instance, where 400 members of the House are on one side and 35 on the other, you need to reflect that in the reporting. But that doesn't mean that you need to say how you feel about it.
We hear so much about the increasing political divide in Washington. From your perspective, how has Washington changed in the years since you've been covering it?
Oh, it's gotten progressively nastier and more polarized. And to some degree, so has the country, but not to the degree that is reflected in the Congress. And that's something that a lot of people are thinking about and talking about at the dedication of the Edward M. Kennedy Center in Boston on Monday. President Obama talked about bipartisanship and being able to be collegial even when you disagree. And several of the senators who were there were Republicans, like John McCain, who said, I disagree with Ted Kennedy all the time. And we would really go at it on the floor of the Senate, but then would walk off and he'd have his arm around me and be laughing. And it wasn't that we didn't both feel very strongly about what we were saying, but we could say, we could argue without being hateful to each other. And that's really what's changed.
And you brought up the Edward M. Kennedy Institute for the United States Senate, which just opened. The institute was the vision of the late Ted Kennedy. Parade Magazine did a cover story on the Kennedy legacy this week and showed former Congressman Patrick Kennedy and Ted Jr. on the cover, who is now a Connecticut state senator. Do you think we'll ever see the Kennedy family return to the prominent political status it once held?
Well, what they're doing is holding a lot of different political offices in a lot of different levels, and also various members of the family doing public service, not in political office. So it's a family that's dedicated itself to the betterment of the community, whichever size that community might be. There is a Kennedy in Congress now, the next generation down, the generation younger than Patrick and Teddy Jr. So there's, you know, there are a lot of Kennedys still to come.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is NPR and ABC political commentator Cokey Roberts, who will be in Pittsburgh tomorrow speaking as Chatham University's Elsie Hillman Chair in Women and Politics. Do you think that social media has been a positive or negative force in journalism?
It's both. Everything is kind of both. You know, everything has its pluses and minuses. There is an advantage to getting information out very quickly, and a lot of people pick things up on a tweet that they wouldn't have gotten for hours or maybe even days later in another time. But obviously, it distracts people. If people are constantly tweeting, they're not reporting, and that's a problem. And also, I think some people are so tied to the responses of readers, listeners, viewers on social media that it affects their coverage, and that's probably not a good thing.
Is that why, unlike a lot of today's journalists and media personalities, you do not have a social media presence?
No, it's really because life's too short. I've got too much else to do, and I just don't feel the need to be in that space. If my grandchildren start tweeting and I have to answer them via Twitter, I suppose I'd start doing it, but that would be the only reason I can think of.
Are we focused too much on the horse race in the coverage of politics and not enough on policy and what these men and women running for high office actually know about the huge problems we face in the world? And by we, I mean, of course, the media.
No, I don't think so. I think that we do a good job, particularly at NPR, but in other mainstream media as well, do a good job of putting the issues out there. And as a campaign heats up and we know who the candidates are, we do a good job of letting you know where the candidates stand on all those issues. The truth is, by the time most people start paying attention to a campaign, it's pretty late in the game. And at that point, the horse race does often become the story. But if anybody wants to know where the candidates are on these issues, it's very easy to find out. It is the thing that is true about information today is that even though there's a lot of it that's just junk, there's a lot of very good information that is permanently there by the virtue of the Internet, so that you can go back and read anything that we might have written in the course of a campaign at any point during the campaign and see where these candidates are. So I think it's a criticism you've heard forever, and it's generally one that's hurled by people who are just paying attention late in the game.
Cokey, does the race for political office, particularly the run-up to the presidential election, is it just too long of a cycle? We're focused a lot on the presidential race of 2016, and this is only the end of March 2015, we've got a year and a half to go.
Well, of course, part of the reason for that is because we haven't seen a situation like this in the Republican Party for a very long time, where we don't have any idea who the nominee is going to be. And that's interesting. That's just fundamentally interesting. You know, nobody knows how it's going to come out. It's a mystery, and mysteries are fun. So I think that that's part of the reason that you're seeing this kind of attention paid this early. But look, the candidates are announcing, you know. Ted Cruz has already announced. Marco Rubio and Rand Paul are expected to announce in the next couple of weeks. Hillary Clinton also, before the month of April is out, is expected to announce. So, you know, we're not making this up. They're doing it. But I have to tell you, Paul, I write history books. And one of the things that makes it very useful for me as a journalist is knowing a lot about American history. And when James Monroe was president, even though everybody knew he would be reelected in 1820, the campaign for the election of 1824, which would be the first one that did not have one of the founders running, started in 1818. They started nominating people even before the 1820 election for the 1824 election. So I think we've improved in terms of the amount of time we spend on this.
That certainly was not the answer I was expecting, but a fascinating one nonetheless. You have written several books about the roles of women in America. How have those roles changed, and where do you think America needs to improve moving forward?
Well, obviously we need to improve in the sense that we need to have many more women representing the 2% of the population that is female. The Senate is now 20% female. I can do that math since there are 100 members of the Senate. And the House is slightly less percentage-wise. In Pennsylvania, your numbers are even worse. You don't have one woman in the 20-member congressional delegation and only one in elected statewide office. So there's a long way to go in terms of women in office. So the future needs to be one where we push harder on along these lines and convince more women to run. As Harry Reid announced at the end of last week that he was not going to run again for office, he had this very interesting statement where he said that, you know, women in the Senate made a difference. He said, and I'm quoting here, "Women are different from men." Okay, good to know that. And and he said, you know, they've improved the Senate greatly, and that is true. And that's true of every legislative body. So the future definitely requires the representation of more women. The past, you know, there are lots of roles women played, and the point of my book's about women in the founding period and the federal period, and I have a new one coming out in a couple of weeks about women in the Civil War period. My point is that they've actually been doing these things throughout our history. We just didn't call it the same thing. But their political involvement and their involvement in the community has been quite remarkable.
Where do you find the time to do all this? I mean, honestly, this is...
I'm not on social media. It saves me a lot of time.
That's the answer. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is NPR and ABC political commentator Cokey Roberts, who will be in Pittsburgh tomorrow speaking as Chatham University's Elsie Hillman Chair in Women and Politics. Cokey, you mentioned that Harry Reid is not going to run for re-election. What do you make of the old guard, particularly Democratic senators, stepping aside? Tom Harkin is gone. Jay Rockefeller is gone. Harry Reid is going. What do we make of this in terms of the transition we're seeing?
Well, you go through periods like this, you know, when people who have been there a long time look around and say, do I really want to do six more years? Harry Reid is 75 years old. He's had a serious injury. And, you know, and it's not saying, do I want to do this job for another year? It's saying, do I want to do it for six more years? And that's a different question. So you often have, just by the luck of the way the Senate is comprised at any given point in time, a period where you see a lot of retirements. And I think the combination of the fact that you had seen a sort of older group of Democrats, plus the six-year cycle, the fundraising, that's what really gets them down. When they think about, do I want to run again and raise all that money? The answer often is no. And then the final thing is what we were talking about earlier, which is this question of a poisonous atmosphere in the body politic. And it's among the voters and it's among the colleagues. And so, you know, how much fun is it? Not a lot.
Do you think, as many do, that this presidential race is going to come down to Jeb Bush versus Hillary Clinton? Or is there someone else who might emerge?
It could go either way. I think right now that Jeb Bush has a lot of convincing to do inside the Republican primary electorate to convince people to go for him. I mean, right now in many polls he's running ahead, but a lot of that has to do with name recognition. He doesn't represent the far right of the Republican Party, and those are the people who tend to vote in primary elections. So he could have a hard time getting the nomination.
Do you think that the Democrats are going to be hurt by not having anyone challenge Hillary?
Yes, I do. I think that it's always good for a candidate to be challenged. And you can make the case that Hillary Clinton has certainly been challenged. I mean, not only in her 2008 presidential run, but she's run for the Senate. She's had a public life where she's had to face a whole lot of challenges. But that's different from having an opponent in the primaries in the year that you want to get elected president. And it's different from dealing with the press in a year when you want to get elected president. And the fact that she does not have a credible opponent at the moment means that she's able to stay aloof from the people in the press. And I don't think that's a good way to run a presidential campaign.
So we have a very interesting and compelling period focusing on politics ahead of us. Do you still get excited about it? Are you excited?
Absolutely. Of course I get excited about it. It's first of all, it's fundamentally fascinating. But secondly, it's incredibly important. We're talking about a person who's going to have a tremendous impact on the lives of every American and on the lives of people around the world. So it's important to try to get it right.
Cokie Roberts is an NPR and ABC News political commentator, and she is going to be in Pittsburgh tomorrow night. She's being honored as Chatham University's Elsie Hillman Chair in Women in Politics, and she'll present the lecture, An Insider's View on Washington, D.C. Cokie Roberts, an honor to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. It was nice to talk to you, and I hope I see you when I'm there. I'm looking forward to being there.
Likewise. Coming up, independent career consultant Sasha King on how to give and receive performance reviews.
You want to look at how your performance measures up. One of the reasons why employee evaluations, especially when you have the initial meetings, can go poorly is because people aren't really honest with themselves about what they did and didn't do.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Your performance at work determines promotions, raises, or staying in a competitive job market. However, most employees don't know how to manage their own performance or give constructive evaluations. Here to explain how to give and receive employee evaluations is career consultant Sasha King. Sasha King, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thank you, Paul.
So, career advisors recommend employees assess their own performance, which I think it's something everyone is curious about. What can employees do to assess their own performance?
What I usually recommend that people do at least once a year is do something, perform what they call a SWOT analysis. SWOT stands for strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. So the beauty of doing that is if you do it for yourself, you start recognizing where your strengths and weaknesses are, and your strengths will give you opportunities, possibly things that you can do for your company to be helpful, and your weaknesses expose you to threats. You shouldn't just do that, on the other hand, for yourself. You should also do that for your role in the company. It gives you a better understanding of possibly where there might be opportunities to manipulate in your favor, in your performance to do a better job. The other thing I always tell my clients is to figure out what you want to tackle in the next year. Plan roughly around December to think about things like how can you improve the efficiency of a company in some way? Maybe it's time, money, procedures. How you'll solve employee problems, maybe productivity, morale, relations with the public, or relations with management, or how can you be a PR person for your company, improve the reputation of a company in the media, clients or customers or competitors. And the last approach that I always tell people to do is what I like to call the capital approach, which takes into account personal capital, what strengths can you use to help your company, intellectual, what industry knowledge will you use to help the company get ahead, and then social, how can you influence management, your industry or coworkers or competition. So you want to take these things into account so that way when you get your employee review, you're not blindsided because you haven't figured an effective way to perform your job the next year.
But part of this is reviewing your own performance, right?
Absolutely.
So it's a lot like, and it helps to be a Catholic to relate to this, but it's like going to confession, right? And admitting certain things that you may be loath to admit to, right?
No, I disagree. I believe that, you know, failure to plan is planning for failure. So creating a plan for how you're going to perform in the next year and adjusting your performance and possibly going with the flow, because sometimes you're going to have to abandon your grandiose schemes here, is going to actually set you up for better productivity and performance, and that's what we found. That's why a lot of companies, when they have you do employee reviews, they will one of the steps they take is they have the employee set goals for the next year.
So how should an employee prepare for their evaluation?
One of the first things I usually tell people to do is review their job description. Look at it, and this is the part where I will agree with you about looking at where you're possibly guilty, is you want to look at how your performance measures up. One of the reasons why employee evaluations, especially when you have the initial meetings, can go poorly is because people aren't really honest with themselves about what they did and didn't do. So your sins of omission will show up here. Also, you want to examine any notes, memos, sometimes awards, or client reviews, because that helps you track your progress and performance. That's something I keep a track of on a regular basis. One of the things I tell people to do to make sure that they get acknowledged for the work that they do is don't just accept that email saying you did glowing performance. Send that email to your supervisor. Send it to the owner of your company. Let them know that other people think you're doing a good job. The other thing you want to do is track your accomplishments and results. Accomplishments include awards, outside recognition, and maybe building a partnership. Results include things like a percentage of increase or decrease, improving a process, or saving time and money for your company. If you don't track those things, don't expect to get a good evaluation because they're not always going to keep track of those things for you.
How about if you get a bonus? Did you remind them, hey, and by the way, I was rewarded
but
handsomely.
But the bonuses and things of that nature, which we'll talk about a little bit later, generally come for people who are their best self-promoters in the sense that they keep track of their accomplishments, they keep track of their results, they don't hide these things, and they're willing to show these things to the rest of their coworkers or management. And then you want to look at the department and company goals. How did you contribute? One mistake that I see in certain employees is they don't think about what we call small wins or accomplishments that actually matter to your boss. So let me give you an example. Say you're working on a project on social media, but you have a supervisor that really could care less about social media and would rather you spend more time, I don't know, working on writing an article for an established publication. Now, you may have gotten an award from someone on your work on social media, but they may care less about that because they really wanted you to do a stellar job with the article. So making sure you look at the department and company goals and your supervisor's goals are crucial to making sure you get a good review.
What suggestions do you have for managers to help them write effective employee reviews?
The first step you usually want to take with an employee, especially with a new hire or especially after that person survived their 90-day probation, managers, please help the employee create goals so that you have a standard to evaluate them. It's not fair to give someone a poor evaluation if you have not set forth the standard in which you're going to measure their performance. Another thing is you want to also give them the opportunity to let them rate their own performance. This may reveal accomplishments that you may know about, but it also lets you know if there's a real disconnect between how they view their performance and how you view their performance, you'll start understanding the root of it. You also want to review the job description, their personnel file, and the department or corporate goals. How do they contribute? Did they accomplish something? Are they lacking somewhere? So if they need more training or have personal habits like not being punctual, you can talk about it there. Another thing I always tell for my managers is please be professional in this. They've published several books with phrases for employee evaluations. Please take one of those books, go ahead and buy them. Make sure you write those evaluations with those things in mind so that you have a more professional looking evaluation. Another huge mistake I see with a lot of professionals when they're writing employee reviews is they don't review company and HR standards for evaluation.
Whoops.
That's huge because what might happen is you might miss rule standards for regulations that the company has. And if you give someone a poor review, if HR really – you haven't discussed this with them, this can create problems down the road. So you want to understand their policy and their method. And one of the things I even told some of my managers to do is if you feel uncomfortable and never feel properly trained on how to do an employee evaluation, don't be afraid to pull aside the HR professional and have them give you some clues. Now, my favorite formula when I'm giving someone feedback on their performance is what I like to call the sandwich method.
Making the sandwich, something good, something bad in the middle, and end with something good.
Exactly. The reason why you want to use the sandwich method is people are more likely to listen to you if you recognize and reveal some of their good traits. Understand that perhaps a few of their bad tendencies may hurt their performance, but also still understand that the bottom line, they're trying to do a good job. You will, in the end, get a much better relationship with that employee and have a much higher level of performance if you do that.
It's an honest review to do it that way, and that way you've got a lot more credibility with
because you're not harping on the person saying you're doing all these things wrong, but never highlighting anything you've done right. And sometimes with some of my older professionals, because of the way they were trained in the era, that's kind of what they do. But you really don't want to do that at all.
Jetson, if an employee receives a poor review, what should they do?
First, the thing you should do, take a deep breath, be calm, and make sure you're not taking this review personally. Now, I'm going to be honest and say sometimes employee reviews are a bit subjective, but one thing you want to do is take yourself out of it for a few seconds, okay?
You want to do some role play here?
We're not going to go that far, okay?
Okay.
So the next thing you want to think about is evaluate the review. Is there validity to the criticism? Now, if you decide that yes, you're going to figure out how you're going to improve your performance. So are you going to arrive earlier? Are you going to improve communication with your supervisor? You want to take that into account. If not, if you think that the criticism is really invalid and that someone may be personally attacking you, I want you to really think about whether or not you want to keep the job. And the reason why I say that is if someone gives you a scathing review and you have a rather good rapport with clients and you have some outside recognition or respect, then you have to wonder whether or not this person is giving you a really good objective evaluation or whether their own personal issues are getting in the way. And since managers are human, yes, you should take that into account, because I have seen people's careers virtually destroyed by managers who are less competent than the people who are the experts, who then do not promote them because of their own personal issues. So if you're seeing signs of that, that is okay to start sending out the resumes. It's better to do it if you think there's a personal issue between you and your manager, than invest more time and energy in a company that you may not be able to invest any more in because you'll be blocked in terms of moving up the food chain. The other thing is you have to think about defending yourself. That's something you want to do with kid gloves and do it carefully. Ask for a few days to evaluate the review. Determine what criticism you view differently. So you might want to tread lightly here. An example would be, I appreciate your view that my communication style is direct, but many clients appreciate my approach. You also want to look at the disparity in the review as a sign that there may be communication problems between you and your supervisor. Keep that open line of communication, and you want to make sure they know the smaller things are going on, because I have seen in some cases where you had a group of employees, you had one employee that was doing a stellar job, and three other people weren't. And because you're in that same cohort, you get branded with the rest of the group because they weren't keeping an open line of communication with the supervisor about what was really going on with the dynamics. So that you can shoot yourself in the foot that way. If there's really that kind of problem, please talk about it so you don't get the bad review.
We're talking with career consultant Sasha King about job performance reviews and how to handle them from both an employee and employer standpoint, and how can a manager help improve an employee's performance after a performance review?
The first thing you want to do is reward good behavior and accomplishments. This is where you might want to consider if an employee has worked with you for a while, has seemed satisfied, and has really brought a lot to the table, whether they deserve more compensation or benefits. And also, what resources could you use to help them perform more effectively? If you think that you want to invest in a particular employee long term, could they use a special training program to make them more effective on the job? Or maybe they should be put on the management track. Another thing is, for the clients that you are working with that perhaps had a less than stellar review, you want to focus on the future. Offer training to improve weaknesses, plans goals for improvement that align with the company goals. And you want to create the plans in detail to help them manage a transition to improve their performance. Another thing is you want to take into account, especially if you're having problems with bad performance from a particular employee, is that you want to do a better job of correcting inappropriate behavior results as they happen. Don't let them pile up. Sometimes the flare-up that happens with bad employee reviews is because you ignored the small mistakes until it got to the point that it became such a glut that you had to write a bad review. If you had actually nipped it in the bud immediately, you would have had less problems later.
So address these things early on so that by the time you get to the performance review process, something may have corrected itself by then.
Yes. Keep that line of communication because I see this happen over and over again. But also, if you're having a problem with a set of employees, you also have to wonder what you're communicating in terms of your standards. I remember one client that I worked with that he told me he was worried about leaving his office for a couple days because, you know, I don't know how my employees are going to perform. I said, okay, then you have not trained them well. So we actually worked out a training plan and we created a couple boards so that way we can communicate goals. And after doing that for about 6 months, he left for a trip for a month and he came back and everything was done. So he had trained his subordinates well enough and communicated that goals more effectively to make sure they got their work done.
Career consultant Sasha King joins us each month to address issues in the workplace. Sasha, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much, Paul.
And more Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. With Easter and Passover happening simultaneously this year, business contributor Rebecca Harris looks at the business of the holy holidays. But first, each week, 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. The series explores the city's lesser-known history, connecting its past to its present.
David Bradford had called people to assemble basically as an army to descend on Pittsburgh and burn it to the ground.
It's July of 1794. David Bradford is a Washington County district attorney and the de facto general of a bunch of frontiersmen enraged by the whiskey tax, says Ron Schuller, a lawyer and author who has studied the Whiskey Rebellion. 4 years prior, Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton called for the first tax on a domestic good, distilled spirits. The government really needed the money to pay off the country's Revolutionary War debt, says Meredith Grelly, co-owner of Pittsburgh's first distillery since Prohibition, Wiggle Whiskey.
They were remote on the frontier here and so had very little political agency. And they were again being taxed without representation, which they just fought a war about.
Western Pennsylvanians were represented in Congress, but the tax felt like an affront, says Grelly.
At the height of whiskey making here, there are 4,000 documented stills, and it's truly the economy.
Nearly every farmer had a copper pot still, but they weren't producing massive runs of whiskey, says Schuller. It was more of an insurance policy.
Whiskey at that time was a way of preserving agricultural goods. If you couldn't get them to market and sell them while they were fresh, you could turn grain into whiskey.
In a place where almost no one had cash, whiskey acted as currency. Furthermore, there didn't seem to be any tangible benefits to being a part of this whole federal government thing, says Schuller.
So when Alexander Hamilton came up with this idea of a whiskey excise tax, they sort of said, well, what are we getting for our money?
Back to Bradford and his army. Since Congress had passed the whiskey tax in 1791, Western Pennsylvanians had resisted paying. But the day things really get hot is the day General John Neville, Hamilton's right-hand man in the region, attempts to collect taxes from one Farmer Miller, says Grelly.
He asks Mr. Miller for his whiskey taxes, and Miller says no. And Miller says no by firing a gun at Neville.
There was a fight at General John Neville's house, which resulted in it being burnt down.
Not paying taxes? Illegal. Attacking an agent of the government? Treason. Enter Hugh Henry Brackenridge, a Princeton-educated lawyer, former state representative, and a well-known public figure. He was against the tax, but also against violence, says Schuller.
He really felt that there was a constant sort of tension between chaos and liberty.
Brackenridge doesn't just talk Bradford out of burning Pittsburgh to the ground. He buys 4 barrels of whiskey and invites all the rebels over for a fairly tame party. Crisis averted, right?
George Washington decides to personally lead 13,000 troops into western Pennsylvania.
He'd been reluctant to send troops, says Schuller, but he pulls on his ill-fitting Revolutionary War uniform, gets on his white horse, and rides to Carlisle.
He understood the power of symbolism, and I think the power of symbolism here was, I am your commander-in-chief, and this Constitution is meant to be preserved.
By the time the troops get to Pittsburgh, most of the rebel leaders have fled, but our guy Brackenridge, He faces a personal interview with Alexander Hamilton on suspicion of treason.
It was one of those moments in American history that helps us define how we dissent. There was an acknowledgement that now we understand what you were doing and you were dissenting, but you weren't trying to overthrow the government.
Washington issued a mass pardon. The tax wasn't overturned, but it wasn't particularly well enforced either. And at the end of his presidential term, Washington retired and became one of the largest rye whiskey distillers in the United States. For 90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
UPMC is proud to support 90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. With Easter and Passover falling at the same time this year, there's bound to be a considerable uptick in retailers' sales. Contributor Rebecca Harris joins us this week for a look at the business of these holy holidays with a special focus on holiday foods. She is director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University. Rebecca Harris, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
It's nice to see you, Paul, and I hope our listeners are hungry because we are talking about some great stuff today, Paul.
We are. Holy holidays, Batman.
Oh, I know. I know.
Doesn't that just sound like something Robin would say?
It does. I like it.
We'd like to know what it is that you are making for Easter and or Passover. What are the popular foods that you've eaten over the years? What are the traditional foods? Maybe you're throwing something new into the mix this year. 412-246-2002, the number to call. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm. On Twitter at esspgh. Rebecca, let's start with how often do Easter and Passover occur at the same time as they do this year? It doesn't happen all that often, does it?
No, it really doesn't. The frequent overlapping of these two holidays is pretty rare, and both of them are really major holidays, so they really look deep into the religions, and their matrix is spring, and so both of them are really celebrating spring and rebirth and renewal. So the next time that this happens about the same day is in 2018. So that's not too far away, and that's pretty unusual. I can't remember the last time they really both came at the same weekend, which is nice for us. So our listeners know, as you probably do, Paul, Passover is a holiday commemorating the exodus from slavery for the Jews in Egypt. It lasts about 8 days long, and it starts on the 15th day of Nisan, which is the seventh month in the Jewish calendar. And Easter is calculated as the first Sunday after the full moon that occurs after the vernal equinox. So that's how these days are set. And usually Easter can occur anytime between March 22nd and April 25th. So we really are looking at spring holidays.
And there is a similarity leading up to the two, right? I mean, isn't there the
intertwined religions and significance and history is very broad, and there's a lot of depth to it, and there's a lot of religious significance associated with the foods for the holidays as well as some of the historical significance as well.
Let's talk about the religious significance of certain foods at Easter and Passover.
Well, there are so many interesting things. As we did our research, the items specifically related to Easter foods and are the lamb. So that's very important when you look at the passages and rites of spring. You look at the eggs and rebirth, and ham, which means good luck, and lamb, which is sacrifice, and cake and bread, which is fertility.
Is that where the ham comes from?
That is what our research showed. Yes,
good luck.
It is. Yes.
Because we
were wondering about that when we talked about this last week.
Yeah, last week we got into this conversation about what is the traditional Easter food,
right.
And I can remember everybody making a ham for Easter, and
there you go.
But none of us was really sure why.
So there we go. We answered the question.
I'm glad you
we
took that homework to heart.
Yeah. So, and then there's also, of course, the concept of renewal and rebirth. And the role of the egg in Easter celebrations is also important, and that you can also find in Passover in terms of just the beginning of spring and birth. And so then when we look at Passover foods, we can see really the most important one, which is matzah, and the symbolism of matzah, which is when you look back at the Exodus from Egypt and the biblical narrative about when the Israelites left Egypt in such a haste that they didn't have time for the bread to rise. And so that's why we look at matzah, which is very flat, has no ability to rise, no yeast. And then also the tradition is that matzah really looks at and symbolizes redemption and freedom, and it's the poor man's bread and a reminder to be humble and not to forget what life was like in servitude. So there are some basics that we look at when we look at some of the religious significance in Judaism. Also, you have bitter herbs, which is horseradish, salt, bitter onions, and they're a reminder of bitterness and slavery as well.
We're talking with Rebecca Harris. She is our business contributor. She is also the director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University. We're talking about the convergence of Easter and Passover this year, falling at the same time this year. And what are the traditional foods people eat at Easter and Passover? And we want to hear what you're doing, and it may be something that's off the beaten path. It may be something that's non-traditional, but we'd like to get a glimpse into your life and have you share some traditions or some new things that you're doing with others at 412-246-2002, the number to call, 412-246-2002. The question again is, what are you celebrating Passover and or Easter with food-wise this year, or what has been your tradition down through the years? 412-246-2002. Again, email ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. And so again, the most popular foods we have on the tally sheet.
Yeah, so
because you're always good at the numbers.
The numbers. So I'm gonna
something like how many hams are going to be sold this year.
Right. Now I'm actually not gonna look at numbers. I'm gonna look at items, and so we really want to hear from our listeners. But hot on the Easter side, hot cross buns. So they are traditionally served on Good Friday, and they're spice buns with an icing cross. And so I thought that was really interesting. And it's supposed to mean the moon and four seasons. And the practice was derived from the ancient Anglo-Saxons' preparation of small wheat cakes for the goddess Estra. So that's some interesting history.
I had no idea.
Yeah, so see what you learn on this amazing show. Pretzels. Pretzels have made it to the list of traditional Easter foods because of the fact that it was the first food item that was ever shaped into a person like in prayer. And so they're served salty in Italy. That's unique.
The pretzel has a religious connotation.
It does.
Who knew? Soft pretzels.
Yeah,
or
I don't think with
crunch
mustard. No mustard, but
okay.
Yeah, okay.
But soft pretzels.
Soft pretzels.
Not the crunchy kind.
No.
Okay.
Cured ham. So we talked.
What about peanut butter filled pretzels? Is that?
No.
All right.
No.
Okay.
Move on.
Right,
that
okay
might be peanut butter filled. The eggs. Right. The Easter eggs. So, we talked about dyed Easter eggs. So of course, people really talk a lot about Easter and fertility and rebirth. And then the whole idea of dyeing Easter eggs and having Easter egg hunts and patterns and designs and chocolate eggs. Now, it's interesting. Chocolate eggs were first served in Germany and France, and they were solid, and now a lot of times they're hollowed out, which that's pretty cool. And then we have jelly beans, really jelly beans and malted Easter balls. We talked about some of the people's favorites here last week, and also Peeps. I mean, Peeps. People love these Peeps.
Darn Peeps.
I know. They're pink and blue and purple and green, and they're
everywhere.
Marshmallows.
They're breeding like rabbits.
Right, they are, and they're in the shape of rabbits. So those are some of the fun things that we see.
It's a lot of sugar, and is this, I mean, is this a traditional thing, or is this part of modern society?
I think that's much more modern.
Yeah,
modern
okay
day creation.
I figured. Well, if you can make money, then you're going to do it,
yes,
right?
Right. Well, and I think it's fun. I think everybody likes Peeps. So on the Passover side, what we're seeing is, of course, matzah. And matzah brei, which is a dish that you take matzah and you soften it in milk or water and you fry it with eggs, and that's really good. Haroset is a mixture of usually apples and fresh or dried nuts and fruit and honey and spices. And it's a symbol of mortar and that the Israelites used in building when they were enslaved. And two more things real quick.
Okay, wait. Hold that thought.
Okay.
Hold that thought because we have Kathy in Bethel Park, and I think she's got a sort of a recipe thing, which, you know, we always are into that. So, Kathy, welcome to the show. You're on with Rebecca Harris. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Hi, Kathy. What do you have for us today?
Hi. I have a traditional soup that we make in our family. It's a Polish tradition.
Oh, that's...
We cook kielbasy in water, and we take the kielbasy out, and we add some vinegar, a little bit of salt, and then a thickening made with sour cream and a little bit of flour. Wow. We add that to it, and it's we just simmer it. It comes to be a creamy-looking broth. And then for Easter, we take a bowl and cut up kielbasy, ham, red beets, put in horseradish, some Russian rye bread if we have that, the kielbasy ham, and the hard-boiled egg. And then we... spoon the broth over it, and it turns this beautiful shade of pink from the red beet juice. And then you've got the colors of the egg, the yellow of the egg and the white of the egg and the kielbasy and ham. It's just a beautiful soup. It's got a strange taste at first. You have to acquire taste for it because it's somewhat sour with the horseradish and the sour cream, but it's a beautiful, beautiful tradition.
You know, and I'm glad that you mentioned that, Kathy, because kielbasa is, that's a big tradition on Easter.
It is. It is. And we normally boil it in our family, but some people bake it or, you know, you can slice it and pan fry it. But this soup has been in our family for years. It was my grandmother's recipe and Mom always made it for Easter. And it's the only time of the year we make it.
Wow. Well, I thank you for sharing this.
Thanks,
you're welcome. And thank you for giving us the opportunity to share a recipe with someone and traditions.
And Kathy, make sure to write that down so that it carries on to the next tradition.
Right.
It's really, and generation, it's really important that you do that. And I love that it's pink. I love that. That is so great.
Yeah.
Thanks,
if you,
Kathy.
If you'd ever want the recipe, you can just, if you want me, I can send it in to you.
Yeah, you know what? Why don't you? And then we can have it up on our website at WESA.FM. If you don't mind sharing it, Kathy, which
no, not at
clearly
all.
You
we
don't.
We call it bosht. But it's not the borscht, a red beet soup that you usually find if you look it up.
Okay, great. Thanks,
okay,
Kathy.
Thank you
very much. We appreciate that. Now, you had some more.
So I just have a couple more specialties.
Right.
Gefilte fish, which is something that also is in for Passover. And then Jewish matzo balls.
But isn't gefilte fish anytime, really?
Well, but you really don't eat it anytime. If you really do it the right way, you really make it from the fish. And it's a huge, long process. And then matzo ball soup, which is really a favorite. And I see,
speaking of which, David on Twitter says Passover means matzo braai on Sunday morning with fresh fruit and yogurt.
Oh, man. I think we're just going to alternate and go to all these people's homes
with
all
these
goodies. Did
I say that
right?
Okay,
matzo
good.
Braai, which is a delicacy. It's
excellent.
Wonderful.
All right.
Yeah.
And so what is made here locally for Easter/Passover that is really unique? I think Kathy's recipe was pretty unique, but in the last 45 seconds or so that we have?
We have at the Priory Fine Pastries, you can find some desserts for Passover and check out a couple of things that they have. I know that you can also find, it's not necessarily local, but you can buy it locally. Ben and Jerry's now do a Haroset Passover ice cream flavor. Can you believe it?
No.
I know. I
mean,
it's Ben and Jerry's. They kind of do everything. So it doesn't. It's really quite remarkable. So I can't even tell you what it tastes like, but I recommend that you try it. And one of the best-selling desserts forever and ever is Cadbury cream eggs, one of the best Easter sellers in the U.S. and the U.K. since 1923. There you have it.
That makes me wish I had an Easter basket
right now
coming. Yeah, exactly. And then maybe find a Fabergé egg in there. That would really top it all off. Rebecca Harris is our business contributor. She's director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University. Rebecca, as always, great thanks.
It's been a pleasure. Happy spring.
Thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any portion of the show or you'd like to revisit past segments, you can go to our website at wesa.fm. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.